Welcome to Carrying Wayward, a supernatural podcast for fans who aren't ready to let go and newcomers to the series who are ready to jump in. I'm Drew Schulman.
And I'm Marie Vigourou. In this episode, we're diving into Supernatural Season 8, Episode 4, Bitten. Let's get this show on the road. I will be at New Jersey Con from May 17th to 19th, and we basically wanted to do something special for people who would want to save on some shipping costs and who are interested in our merch and will be going to New Jersey Con. Like we said last week, we're not going to have a booth because that wasn't the goal of the trip, and we won't be selling merch there. However, if you buy merch in advance, it would be my pleasure to meet up with you at the con to be able to deliver it to you. We have actually right now a post on Ko-fi and Patreon that explains all of the details. So again, if you're going to New Jersey Con and you would like a Carrying Wayward pin, a tote, or a print, or all three, and you don't want to pay for shipping, just head over to carryingwayward.com.
And if you're like me and you are not going to New Jersey Con, we can just be jealous together. I'm so excited for you, but I'm so jealous. Like, I love going to cons and like the opportunity to meet more people and like just be, I don't want to take it away from you, but I'm so jealous I can't be going with you.
If you are going to New Jersey Con, come and see me if you see me. I'm going to be hopefully recognizable. I'm going to have like stuff on me that's going to show who I am. So please like come and see me. It would be my pleasure.
I'm just picturing like that cartoon style, like big neon sign, like Genie from Aladdin with like this arrow pointing at you, just like floating around.
That honestly sounds like a nightmare, just saying.
Real hard to miss. This week, patrons and Ko-fi supporters got to hear us answer the question, have you ever made or acted in an indie movie, for school or otherwise, on the supporter-exclusive Impala Talk feed. You can go to carryingwayward.com to support us and claim your perks.
What did we think of this episode? This was a bit of a departure, wasn't it?
Right away, reminiscent of our Ghostfacers episode. We're seeing it through the eye of a third party, and Sam and Dean are very ancillary to the story. Like, it's their story, but they're really not the focus. They're just in it.
I would actually argue that it's not their story. They are but like passengers or secondary characters in this particular story.
I think they more often play the butt of a joke to them than anything else in this episode, which is very fun.
Oh, we'll talk about that.
It was such a weird departure that I kind of like really got to enjoy it more than I expected. I like the fact that the episode's called Bitten, and at no point did I assume vampires. I just totally, like, not even, like, nope. That's too on the nose. It could not be that.
That's really funny. Do you want to give us a recap of this episode before we get started?
Count me down.
3, 2, 1, Lord of the Flies.
We have what looks to be some sort of, like, home video project. Some kids in school working with their really high-tech, up-to-date cameras that look like they are out of a Goodwill today. One of them goes off into the woods and gets bitten by something and now has super strength and it healed right away. And then we find out later that he ripped out some dude's heart that was like, you know, a shitty bully, but not like we're condoning murdering shitty bullies, but I mean, shitty bully. The friend Brian is all like, bite me too. I want to be super cool. He also weirdly has a thing for Mike's girlfriend, even though he liked her first. And it's a really weird, like, love triangle thing we'll get into. But then he confronts the teacher who actually bit Mike in the first place and essentially, like, outs him and lets Sam and Dean lead Sam and Dean to killing him. But he gets bitten also. And then they get into a werewolf fight where Mike gets killed and then Kate gets bitten, which is super fucked up. She kills and gets away and leaves, like, the footage for Sam and Dean, which is what we're seeing. We kind of get to see, like, what they miss from the point of view of these kids' time.
I love how they chose to tell this story. It is so, like, of its time in the best of ways. Because we often talk about Supernatural as being very of its time in, like, kind of a very cringy way. But here we're actually able to say, oh my god, it is of its time. Like, I look at it with nostalgia. I'm like, this was my youth. Like, this was my early 20s, you know?
I feel this. Like, as a film student, like, the walking around with a camera and, like, looking for what to film and, like, trying to figure out your next project, some of that hit way too close to home for me.
This episode was written by Robbie Thompson, directed by Thomas J. Wright, and it originally aired on October 24th, 2012.
For what I assume they were going for, which was that found footage, like, Blair Witch thing, they did it right. This feels like the way it was meant to be done.
So first, I do want to say that because of the format of this particular episode of Supernatural, we're just not going to have that much of a long game. Like, we just don't have that much of a story time either. But we're going to get to that in a minute.
I think it's nice once in a while to have these odd episodes or these weirder structures, because it allows us to do something a little different and weird. I'm looking forward to this recording as much as I enjoyed the episode.
So we meet Kate, which is cool, although, you know, the circumstances of that meeting are truly awful.
I'm sorry, the way you say that, it makes it sound like we meet her again.
I just said we meet Kate, that's all.
I had completely written this off, like, as far as, like, one-off characters who get away and we sort of just, like, let them linger, like the Antichrist and the Ruguru child, I have convinced are, like, some sort of, like, West Coast X-Men style team.
Absolutely love that I spend hours taking these notes and you're like, what?
Hey, your notes are valid, but it just goes to show the show has trained me to not expect one-off characters like that to show up unless we get a little more out of them. She seemed a lot more Antichrist than she did Charlie on the scale of stay and go.
I totally understand that.
We get a werewolf coming back? Hell yes.
Kate wants to be a lawyer, which made me think of our Sammy boy, obviously. And just like him, her university journey is cut short because her romantic partner is murdered.
I definitely made the lawyer connection and the idea of, like, school being ended, but the idea that it was ended in the same way of, like, what we would consider a monster killing her lover? Huh.
And then she has to go in order to, you know, live in a world full of monsters on her own. She has to leave everything behind the same way that Sam did in those first seasons.
My enjoyment of this episode has just tripled in knowing that Kate isn't just theoretically gone like I expected.
So we do get some new lore about werewolves and how the ones that are turned up to like four generations from pureblood are less feral and can transform like before, during, and after the lunar cycle.
As far as retconning your own lore goes, not a terrible way to do it.
I mean, I feel like this is really in line with the whole like John was a bad hunter and just didn't teach his sons properly. And so they are now, like, having to reevaluate all of the lore that he's ever taught them.
Any chance to call out John's terrible abilities as hunting is great. But it gives me hope, deep down, that maybe we never actually see them transform. We see, like, some, like, hints of it with the claws and the teeth, but we never see a full transformation. Maybe they get to be more wolf-like. I know they don't, but I could dream it.
I don't want to set unrealistic expectations for you.
Don't worry, I know it's not happening, but I can dream.
This week, our theme is media references. Now again, because of the format of this episode, we kind of had to make some changes to like our own format. We have like so little background info on like Kate, Michael, and Brian. This would have been like a really short story time. So we figured that we would use this time to talk about like the different media references that are made in this episode, whether it's like movies, TV, or books, and talk about how those references speak to the story that this episode is telling. This is me being a little cheeky here, but I really want us to notice that this was written by Robbie Thompson, who would also go on to be the showrunner for the Winchesters, right? So, like, this is something that he does, that he uses existing pieces of media and pop culture in order to tell part of the story. This idea of, like, grabbing references to previous media and using those to emphasize the story is, like, very present in the Winchesters, particularly.
I mean, also, just in general, like, the way Dean is written, I know Sam dabbles in it a bit as well, but they are, as we've discussed in the past, two boys who were very much raised by television when John wasn't around. So they have a lot of media references themselves. So the show is already like lightly littered with them. So to kind of go into a focus of how the show can use them to their advantage is great.
Full disclosure, we know that we're probably going to be missing a bunch of them. So send us voicemails to let us know what we missed and what you think that it says about this episode. So first off, let's get this out of the way. Like the filming and the editing style of this episode is what we call found footage. Now, I had no idea just like how many movies actually use this style, Like, the ones that came to my mind immediately were, like, Cloverfield from 2008 and The Blair Witch Project from 1999. Tiny little bit of background on that. Even though other films had used this before, The Blair Witch Project is really the movie that made this style as popular and as known as it is today. Or especially, like, as popular as it was, like, in the early 2000s, I would say. That was a thing, capital T. And so when I search for found footage movies, I sort of would guesstimate that about 99.9% of them were horror movies. And if we go back even pre-filmmaking time, there are some novels that were also written in a similar style, and a lot of the time it's like characters writing letters to each other. Think like Dracula by Bram Stoker, think Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, and think The Call of Cthulhu by H.P. Lovecraft. So again, these are all horror novels, and so to kind of circle back to like what this media reference says about the story, well, it's pretty simple, but it's that it's a horror story, and like the found footage style lets us know that from the get-go, right? So it tells us immediately this is going to be a horror story.
I think the reason it's so prevalent in horror is like by default, it obscures the story. Like suddenly nothing is to be trusted because it's no longer a filmmaker telling us a story in the third person. It's one of the characters in the world who is prone to mistakes or their own whims. It brings the unreliable narrator into the spotlight. The same goes for the written perspective of letters or a journal, perhaps. Horror and suspense do their best work when we as an audience are left as much in the dark and forced to imagine what is in the unknown than when it's baked into the medium of the story. It allows us to better connect with the characters who are feeling the same way we're feeling versus that third-person perspective you usually get in a film.
Arguably, even a third person is never really removed from the story being told, right? Like the way that even an omnipotent narrator would tell a story shows what this narrator believes in and what they value. To kind of come back to what you were saying about the unreliable narrator being a third person, I do want to highlight that this is, again, something that happens in the Winchesters. You know, think about who is narrating the story in this series. Think about how it's done. Didn't know that we were going to do a whole episode on the Winchesters.
I mean, like, that's one of those things where it's, like, over my head. Like, I don't know what you're referring to when you say unreliable narrator. Is it John? I don't know.
I don't know. Is it Dean? Is it Sam? Who knows? Is it Cass?
Is it the ghost of Bobby?
Maybe. The footage is actually filmed by the three of them, right? And I think that that is different from, like, your typical found footage thing, which is usually one person's point of view. Even in the Ghostfacers, it was like just a couple of people filming, not everybody necessarily, right? Some of them had cameras. This is a little bit different than what we've seen before.
Also, I guess at that point, we have to assume that Kate put some level of editing towards all of it. Like, she's the one who sat down with all the footage and made something. It raises the question, one, of how much did she cut? Or is there any bias because of that?
This is her prerogative. That's what storytellers do. That is literally what Robbie Thompson did when he wrote the story. That is what, you know, Mary Shelley did when she wrote Frankenstein. Like, that is just what storytellers do. They pick and choose what they want to show. So at the beginning of the episode, Kate mentions the movie Last Year at Marienbad, which is a French film from 1961 directed by Alain Resnais. Now, this caught my attention because Supernatural, like you were mentioning earlier, is really famous for making these like off-the-cuff pop culture references, especially through Dean. But it's rare that they're going to name drop something like this. Like, Dean will mention like, oh yeah, this character from this obscure B-movie. But like Last Year on Marienbad, like that is a title and then they talk about it a little bit. So like that's different from the kind of pop culture references that we usually get.
Why would you choose this film of all films? I'm assuming you'll have an answer.
So here they're name dropping a movie for what at the time would have been like a 50-year-old movie. And so my spidey senses kind of like tingled. See, I'm also making references. So like there's a lot to be said about this movie, especially if we start analyzing it through a modern lens. But like at a baseline, it's a love triangle. And I use love quite loosely. Again, due to our modern context, because if I read the plot description from Wikipedia, and I did edit it for brevity and for clarity, in a hotel populated by wealthy individuals and couples who socialize with each other, a man approaches a woman and claims that they met the year before at a similar resort and had a romantic relationship, but she responded to his request to run away together by asking him to wait a year, which has now elapsed. The woman insists that she has never met the man, so he proceeds to attempt to remind her of their shared past while she rebuffs him and contradicts his account. Between interactions with the woman, a second man, who may be the woman's husband, asserts his dominance over the first man by repeatedly beating him at a mathematical game. I swear this is in the plot. Through ambiguous flashbacks and disorienting shifts in time and location, the film explores the relationships between the three characters. At the end of the film, the woman leaves the hotel with the first man.
Part of me now really wants to see this, both for, like, what would lead her to leave this supposed possible husband for this stranger she claimed she didn't know a year ago. And what is this mathematical game? Like, I picture just two men in, like, these brilliant suits and, like, a 50-year-old, like, I don't know why we're Victorian, doing Sudokus.
This, to me, feels very White Lotus. If for those who have watched it, White Lotus is a series that only, like, that is only a couple years old, right? So this did not exist at the time, but I'm like, this feels like White Lotus kind of fits in the same category. So there's a couple of things that I'd sort of like to focus on, and the first being the storytelling style of that particular movie, which is said to be like ambiguous and disorienting, just like this episode, like we talked about before. There's like this quote unquote love triangle, which is also pretty prominent in this episode. Although, is it really a love triangle if it's a couple with a third person obsessing over one person in the couple? Then the other thing that I want to highlight here is how this episode actually subverted the expectations that were set by the plot of this movie by having Kate not leave with Brian. Because when we talked about found footage earlier, we said that it set the tone for the genre of the story. So it would have made sense to think like, oh, they're taking inspiration from Last Year at Mary and Bad, Kate is going to end up with Brian. And like, I just want to say thank you to Robbie Thompson for not doing that. Like, thank you for knowing better, for doing better, like we talked about last week. And to quote Lady Gaga, I don't believe in the glorification of murder. I do believe in the empowerment of women.
I like that the theme continues here in like obscuring the truth from the audience. Like, we get to set up of comparing this episode to this classic film, only, as you said, to subvert the expectations regarding the outcome. However, I think the love triangle does this too, as yes, it's Mike and Kate with the third wheel slash obsessive Brian, but it seems like a true triangle to me in the sense that while Brian is obsessed and air quotes in love with Kate, Kate loves Mike, and Mike has like an extreme affection and love and like attachment to Brian, and we even see it a bit in Brian towards Mike when it comes to, like, you know, stopping the teacher from basically using him as a scapegoat. I feel like it downplays Brian by saying his only connection to this is being obsessed with Kate, whereas I think the, like, bromance or, like, somewhat of, like, a familial, almost brotherly relationship between Brian and Mike is very valuable as well.
Now, the last thing that I wanted to mention here with regards to Last Year at Mary and Bad is that basically that part where the men keep fighting at some kind of math game. And it made me think of like the commentary on masculinity, which really feeds super well into the third media reference that I want to talk about, which is Lord of the Flies. Professor Ludensky, who turns out to be a werewolf in the end, he's teaching Lord of the Flies. And later in the episode, Brian says that he doesn't want to be Piggy. I personally really see that as a commentary about masculinity, especially about like nice, nerdy guys, right? Like, Brian sees himself as, like, lesser than. He's lesser than Michael because he's not as good looking, he's not as charming, he doesn't get the girl. What he sees in all of those things is that he's less of a man. And so, in an attempt to make himself more of a man, he confronts Professor Ludensky and he has him bite him so that he can be a werewolf too, just like Michael. You know, and he says, like, I did what you couldn't do, I'm protecting Kate. Brian leans really heavily into those like very toxic ideals of masculinity. And in the end, that's really the reason why things end up as they do. Like, Brian's bruised ego is the reason why Michael and Brian and arguably Professor Ludensky die.
The idea of a story about someone trying to fill a role they feel they need to and taking the wrong lessons from it, i.e. needing to grow up into a big, strong, masculine, toxic man and become, as he has become, this toxic masculinity icon that he thinks is what he is supposed to be, is very telling. We know this because while it may be the theme of many stories, maybe even dabbled in over the past several seasons of Supernatural, hint, hint, nudge, nudge. It's something real, sadly, and that's where these stories come from, is they're taking real-life things and putting them to paper and making you look at the example and realize it.
This was also the time, I will remind folks, because, oh my god, where there was a lot of Shakespeare plays that were adapted into teen movies, okay? I feel ancient saying this. In my day, we watched Shakespeare movies. And so, again, like, taking these, like, Western Universal stories, like, quote-unquote, and putting them in a modern context is actually really useful for people to be able to understand them, because sometimes, like, either the language is difficult, like, it's just, like, it's not easy, especially if English is not your first language. So, like, to put those in a, like, plain English-speaking, like, relatable environment allows you to connect with stories that otherwise, like, you might have more trouble connecting with. And so I think that this is exactly what's happening here. Like, this story was an adaptation of many other stories that were told in the past, but told in such a way that it was relatable for the audiences of the time. And that's why I keep saying this is so of its time.
I feel like there's criticism of, like, oh, there's no original stories anymore. But it's the taking of a story that has lost relevance through its age, but not its message, and being remade for a modern audience that allows us to not let these stories and these lessons die, and even be further adapted and grow and teach new lessons because of it.
I love everything about this episode, like the clothes, the mason jars, like the film school students, like the iPod doc. Like, it was just so good. It was all so good.
I think even just Dean putting it back on the dock when he leaves was, like, very, like, the end of Breakfast Club. Like, it really felt like the music coming over the end of the movie. Like, this is the end. The music's playing us off now. It was, like, a really interesting, like, reversal.
There's also some quick references in this episode. One of them to X-Men. When Kate and Brian and Michael are trying to guess, like, what it is that bit Michael. And Brian says, maybe a mutant bit you.
I love this. It just builds up for me what kind of media they consume and the different layers of them. Like, it's an easy way to help us understand our protagonists in this type of presentation. And again, like, I think just like the X-Men as a whole is such an incredibly deep, like, dive into, like, media understanding, like, media literacy when it comes to the X-Men is, like, this huge, weird bubble. Like, we literally have, they're relaunching the 1997 X-Men cartoon, like, follow-up now, and the number of people who are looking at this being like, oh, they've, like, ruined the X-Men by making them woke, and then it's just like, have you not watched the X-Men before this, and the entire message of inclusivity, and everyone is different, and that's okay, we should support each other, and we shouldn't hate people for being different than us? They're looking for what made him different, not what the scary bad thing is. And the suggestion is a mutant or an X-Man, not that it's a bad thing, that it's just a thing, and what does that mean for the next steps?
So I do want to highlight that the first X-Men movie came out in 2000, which is really close to Blair Witch in 1999. So we're really seeing, like, those movies that, like, clearly seem to have affected Robbie Thompson. Which is really cool because they're, like, the same movies that I really loved.
I want a movie night with Robbie. Like, I'm down. What are we watching, Robbie? Come on over. I'll make popcorn.
There's also a bit of a long-running reference to X-Files, which I was super excited. And, like, it sort of made me realize that if I hadn't watched it, thanks to Chris and Jeremy from Nonhuman Biologics, I just wouldn't have caught it. Like, I sort of caught it when I first watched it. Well, the first... very few times that I watched Supernatural. I didn't really catch it. Like, it was there, but I didn't really get it. Because at that moment, Kate goes, well, maybe you got bit by an alien. That would explain the FBI. Like, that is a direct reference to Mulder and Scully. And then later in the episode, Michael goes, is it just me, or are you getting a workplace romance vibe from those two? About 17, which, like, we won't go into that pairing, but, like, that is also a direct reference to Mulder and Scully. And then, like, they even refer to the X-Files by name when Brian asks if Michael is an X-File because the FBI is looking for what bit him.
I knew it'd be a highlight for both of us. Even going as far as suggesting they might you know, classify their cases at X-File was even better because it begins to blur the lines between fiction and nonfiction. Like, they aren't referring to these cases like an episode of the X-Files, but like an actual X-File the FBI might investigate, that like the real life people of this world would consider real.
Are you saying that the X-Files are not real?
Let me get my mind-wiping device.
Enter Man in Black.
But it does start to show us that like there's a line between fiction and reality, for Brian at least, that may be thinner for him than for others. And that, I think, also relates to the way he connected to Lord of the Flies and being, and like seeing himself in Piggy, in that he had to make these changes because he felt so directly linked to a character that his own line between real and fiction began to blur a bit. I think there is an image of the nerdy type of character that has been portrayed a lot in earlier media, like pre-2010s, of this like level of escapism in this kind of media where like the reason nerds love Superman is because they want to be the hero who gets the girl. I'm not saying that is true. I'm saying it's a perception, I think, that people projected onto nerdier people. So to have a character who feels like he is the second fiddle to Mike, he wants to be the main character. He doesn't want to be the Piggy of the story. He wants to be the leader of the story. And if he can't be the leader, he can at least be co-leader with his best friend and best buddy.
And then there's also a reference to Starsky and Hutch and Rosalian Isles.
The Starsky and Hutch one I caught for sure. And I think it's always a fun little thing of like whenever you refer to two characters as like the Starsky and Hutch or the Dana and Scully, of like which one's which. There were just so many little Easter eggs in this episode. And as we said at the top of the episode, I'm sure we've missed a few. We'd love to know more about them.
So this week we've had our critical talk in the first half of the episode, so I'm not going to add to that. But I would love to do a quick story time discussion about the little bit of time where we do get Sam and Dean and we get out of the found footage technique and like back into our usual storytelling style at the very end. Because something very important, and I would argue unusual, actually happens. So like the brothers find the apartment, they find the bodies, the blood, the gore, the footage. They watch it, they piece everything together, and then Sam goes, all right, so what, she's got like half a day jump on us? Like, he's really assuming that they're just gonna go and like stalk and hunt her at this point, right? And he makes that assumption because it's usually what Dean does. He's like, rah, rah, a monster is a monster, we kill monsters. But like this time, Dean is just like, meh. And Sam sees this and he goes, well, look, Kate's right. Like, she hasn't hurt anybody, well, anybody human at least. And this is where we should all be very surprised that Dean says, yeah, she didn't. She didn't choose this. Let's give her a shot. Like, what? Who are you and what have you done with Dean Winchester? Like, Sam is also surprised by this because, it's not just me, right? Like, Sam is also surprised.
1,000%. I was with you on that one of like, wait, what? Dean's just like cool with this suddenly? I wonder if it has to do with any monsters he's encountered recently and maybe got a little friendly with.
And this is really what I want to talk about, because like you said, what has happened in Dean's life recently that would make him more understanding towards monsters? Like, is there someone new in his life that could possibly soften the hard lines that Dean has historically drawn about who is a monster and who is not? And of course, I'm being facetious here, but I would like to point us toward Benny, because it seems like knowing Benny has humanized monsters for Dean quite a bit. And again, it seems like Dean is drawing parallels between Benny and Kate. And poor Kate, like all she ever did was be in love with a boy. And now I know that you don't see Benny as a love interest for Dean, but I think that all poor Benny ever did was be in love with a boy.
With each passing episode, albeit not today's per se, but our conversation, I'm definitely seeing the Benny love Dean thing. I just still see Dean too hung up on Cass to reciprocate it.
Okay. All right. Cool, cool.
It very much feels like a love triangle where there is clearly a couple and a third one who's obsessed with one of the two.
Oh, you have no idea what you just said. Sweet summer child.
I want to see more of Benny. I don't know what it means, but I want to see more of him.
Before we move on, if we do see Benny and Kate as mirrors for one another, then what do we make of Sam saying, and look, if Kate pops back up, I mean, if she strays, then no questions asked. We do what we gotta do and we take her down. Foreshadowing much?
I very much assume the introduction of Benny to Sam will be through the guise of, like, wait, don't kill him, he's a good guy, I promise, from Dean. Which I think opens up a thousand directions my mind wants to spiral in. And depending how far back in past interactions we're willing to dig into, we'll have to save that conversation for another day.
This week we have a message from Ruby, and before we listen to it, we want to remind you to send us a 3-minute voicemail to respond to anything we discussed today or to ask us a question. You can use the recording app on your phone and email us the recording at carryingwayward@gmail.com.
Hey, this is Ruby. I was just getting into episode 15, The Benders, and I have some thoughts that I figure I would put in here too, because I think it's something I'm always interested in discussing with people when I talk about this episode and this season in general. And I figured I would share it with you. I don't know, maybe you would also find it interesting to discuss. But I feel, you guys were talking about, this episode having the theme of the evilness of mankind or the duality of man. And I feel like just looking at this episode, makes that conversation a little bit difficult, because I feel like this episode isn't so much starting a conversation as it is continuing one. Because if you look at where it comes in the first season of Supernatural, we just had the episode with Max. We just had the episode where we're starting to talk about Sammy and his powers. We also had Faith, the episode Faith in this season, and I feel like this episode is just another one in a long conversation of, is what the brothers are doing, is it actually good? Is them hunting things, saving people, actually them doing the most good, or is it just we were trained to be hunters, to be killers of evil things, and this person is doing an evil thing? At what point does that person become a monster? It's also kind of continuing the conversation from Faith of, you know, who gets to decide who lives and dies? The Benders are taking people, they're kidnapping them, they're killing them. Obviously, like, we are led in this episode to believe that is wrong. Why is that wrong when it's portrayed almost as a good thing that the policewoman kills one of them at the end, kills the man who killed her brother? Why is it okay that Dean wanted to kill Max? Like, at what point do the brothers stop being heroes and start being monsters if the people that they're hunting are just that, people? They're just people doing bad things. How many bad things does it take to balance the scale? And can it be balanced in that way? I feel like that's kind of a thing that's in conversation this whole season, and in lesser ways in conversation the whole show, at least till season 5 when they change showrunners and it gets a little messy for a while. But yeah, it's one of those conversations I find very interesting to have with other viewers of the show, because I feel like so many of the episodes, especially of the first season, are also having that conversation, even if it wasn't necessarily intended. So yeah, that's my piece. Bye.
Ruby, thank you for the message. Right away, like, the first thing that comes to mind is that we just spent an episode talking about literally Kate, who is this character who she admits to killing somebody. She essentially put footage of herself killing somebody and gave it to a pair of hunters. Like you said, the show has had this conversation with us and for us for so long. And as we enter this season, season 8, I feel like it's a conversation that's almost like resurfaced more, in that we have Benny, who Dean seems to trust and see the good in and has a positive relationship with, despite the fact that we know he's a monster. We have Kate, who just killed basically, but, you know, like, as they said, didn't kill any humans. And then it raises the question of, like, what, where do you draw that line? Because personally, I think the family in the Benders is, on a scale of human to monster, closer to the monster end of the scale than a werewolf who's doing this out of, like, a basically a curse or disease upon them and not because they like it. You know, we looked at last episode or a few episodes ago with the people who received the organ transplants and were continuing this trend because it made them stronger and better. You know, like, that's, they're choosing to do it. Like, there's so much nuance to this. And for me, I think the thing you raise the most is, well, I don't think I can sit here and say what Sam and Dean do is bad or makes them bad people. I think ultimately they are doing a good for the universe on the karmic scales. It really does come down to, like, when does it just become like, okay, this is a murderer the cops won't catch and we know he's murdering people. Let's go kill him too. Like, where do you draw that line between judge, jury, and executioner? Which I think is, like, I'll be honest, a question that is too big for me to answer right this second. But definitely something that the show does want us to consider when it comes to a family like the Benders, who are not supernatural beings, but as monstrous as many of the things we've seen before.
I definitely see things differently, because I see the family in the Benders as also a commentary on class. They're poor, right? They have no money. They have no access to resources, to society. They've been ostracized. And so they're quite isolated. There's a commentary there about, like, poor people, particularly in the United States, because this is in a very American context, but arguably in other Western countries as well, about, like, the inhumanity of poor people and people of lower class. And that really disturbs me. And I think that even people who do monstrous things deserve due process and deserve justice, not just revenge. So starting from there, this is why I'm always very outspoken whenever I find that in the seasons that are going to come, when Dean does things that I'm like, that is not just. What you're doing is not just. You are justifying it through your own value system, kind of like vigilante. However, like, what you are doing is not just. We saw a lot of that, Ruby. You're absolutely right with Sam in season 4 when he's, like, doing all of the things to, like, you know, it's for the greater good. It's for the greater good. And then he ends up, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Like, this is exactly what's going on. And I think that there's, in the whole series, kind of a commentary on that as well, where, you know, one thing a monster doesn't make, however, a pattern of behavior is where you can start using that word, I think, anyway. And this is why, like, I know that, you know, this is kind of a taboo thing to say, but, like, I'm not sure that I really call the brothers heroes, because I think that a lot of their means are very, the means that they use to get to their ends are very questionable sometimes. Again, I feel like sometimes people who, especially, and again, I'm going to talk about Dean because from now on, like, there's a much bigger emphasis on Dean, but, like, there's, like, a difficulty in being critical of Dean's actions sometimes. It's as if when you say that he does a bad action, that people assume that you say he's a bad person. I mean, I think that that comes from projection and whatever. I love this conversation, Ruby. Thank you so much for starting it with us. And that is a conversation that we will be continuing all the way until season 15. So after this lively conversation, do you have any reflection and call to action?
I do, and to kind of take a sampling from this episode and kind of going at it from a slightly different angle than usual, I almost want to use this as a moment to reflect on my own consumption of media and how it, like, media consumption, I think we all do this, or a lot of people I know do this, not to generalize, but, like, it affects my mood and how I go about my days. Like, I've definitely had nights where I've been in, like, a bad mood and I put on a show that I, like, just need to get through, and because it's not something I enjoy, I like just get myself into a deeper pit. Or I've been the reverse, where I need a good cry and I find a movie that I know will just push me over the edge and let me get my emotions out. The media I consume does affect my day-to-day, like, going-ons, and my call to action is to be more aware of this. And I mean, even just as a positive, like, when I know I need a pick-me-up, know the shows that'll pick me up and give me the little bit of joy I need a day when I'm having an off day.
On my end, this episode has made me feel called to just watch more movies, honestly. Like, storytelling is, like, one of those things that you understand better and better the more stories you, like, consume. I don't know, it just made me wanna consume more.
This was Carrying Wayward, a supernatural podcast produced by Rochelle Castellano, hosted by Marie Vigouroux, and myself, Drew Schulman. Thank you to everyone supporting us on Ko-fi or Patreon, especially our Bunker supporters, Elle, Jeremiah Thomas, and Simone. We'd also like to thank Jake Lionheart for our music, and Jacqueline Tucci for additional sound editing. Head over to carryingwayward.com to become a patron or a Ko-fi subscriber, and for our merch store and socials. And write us a review on Apple Podcasts. Carry on, our wayward friends!